Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Agriculture Report and Science in the News, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. From VOA Learning English, I'm June Sims in Washington. Many cities around the world are experiencing population growth, and the list of megacities is expanding. Today, we tell about the South African city of Johannesburg. For many young people, Johannesburg is an increasingly popular place to call home. But first, we look at some changes taking place in New York, the largest city in the United States, and we hear how those changes are affecting one of its neighborhoods. Rising land values have changed the Chinatown area of New York City. Chinatown has long been an important base for Chinese immigrants and their families. It has one of the largest populations of ethnic Chinese outside of Asia. But many are leaving the neighborhood because of the rising cost of housing. Chinatown is now becoming home to many whites and students. The Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund has its headquarters in New York. The group released a report earlier this year. It said there is a similar shortage of reasonably priced housing in Chinatowns in Boston and Philadelphia. The report found an increase in high-cost housing and hotels. It also noted a decline in families and Asian businesses in these Chinatowns. In New York, Mayor Bloomberg's policies are praised for a major decrease in crime. Many of his supporters say higher housing costs are evidence of a city's economic progress. But in Manhattan's Chinatown, those rent increases have already pushed many people out. Numbers from the 2010 census suggest that about 17% of the Chinese people in the area have been displaced since 2000. That is about 6,000 people who have left the neighborhood. Soon Merong has been living in Manhattan's Chinatown since she first came to the United States from Fuzhou in 1990. She owns a restaurant near the center of Chinatown. She says she has seen a large decrease in customers, mostly Chinese immigrants.
In the past, during Thanksgiving holiday, for example, there were too many people on this street outside. You could not walk. But in the past 3 years, nobody is on the street anymore. This is a change we see in Chinatown.
Soon says that many of her neighbors have been forced from their homes after building owners decided to repair and modernize the buildings.
Houses have been renovated, and after that, they just get sold to developers without considering to give it to the people who were living there in the first place, immigrants. The U.S. is a country of immigrants, but many immigrants get here and do not have a place to live or cannot afford it.
For soon, what is happening in Chinatown opposes the very ideals that America stands for. Several organizations in Chinatown are fighting what they see as the destruction of their neighborhood. Li Hua is a secretary of the Chinese Staff and Workers Association. She says her group collected thousands of signatures in an effort to stop plans for new high-priced developments.
We have been protesting against it in all venues possible, at public hearings, with the administration's planning department, to the city council. We have people participating at every step, not just a few but hundreds, but Bloomberg charged on. They just did not care.
New York recently elected a new mayor. Some are hoping for a change in housing policy. Mayor Bill de Blasio has promised to take action to increase reasonably priced housing in the city. You are listening to As It Is. I'm June Sims in Washington. Thanks for joining us. From New York to London, Paris to Lagos, the list of international megacities is growing. Recently, mayors from many of the world's big cities met in Johannesburg, South Africa. These officials gathered to discuss some of the issues facing large cities. Africa is home to two cities with populations of more than 10 million people. Those cities are Cairo, the Egyptian capital, and Lagos in Nigeria. More and more African cities are expanding quickly. Experts predict their populations will increase by millions within the next few years. Faith Lapidus has more in this report from VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg.
Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg praised the urbanization of Africa to the mayors at the C40 gathering.
In 2011, there were 52 African cities with a population higher than a million people. By 2016, in only 2 years, there will be around 65, and that's a good thing.
However, the executive mayor of Johannesburg, Mpo Parks Tau, says this kind of growth creates its own issues.
As people come into the city, there isn't always adequate accommodation to have those people come into the cities, and a lot of them find themselves in inadequate accommodation in slum environments.
Like many people who live in Johannesburg, 24-year-old student Simpiwe Khala came from somewhere else. He left his town in the rural Eastern Cape province to live in Johannesburg. The city is an important trade and transport center for Africa.
Yeah, you're actually staying on your toes. It keeps you on your toes. It's all about hustling. It's all about business. I think I would really get bored if I would have to return to the Eastern Cape.
Sungezo Mkapukisi is also new to Johannesburg. Like many others there, he says he came to the city not for the culture, the mix of people, or the restaurants, but for the money.
We're faced with the reality that our skills, they're only needed in the mega cities, in the metropolitan cities. So, you know, I studied accounting, and there are no jobs for accountants back home.
Lawyer Chris Baird agrees.
All my friends are here. It's a great place in terms of being a young professional, it's where the great work is. It's the economic hub of the country. And really, you know, it's not nearly as pretty as Cape Town, but it's where you need to be if you want to go climb up the ranks.
Hannah Ettinger is a director with the research group Frontier Advisory. She says one of the things that make African megacities special is that there are just not enough of them.
I think what's interesting about African cities, unlike European cities, for example, is there's only a few cities, and these cities are expanding quite rapidly.
Simpiwe Khala, Songezu Mkapukisi, and Chris Baird are among millions of people who have moved to fast-growing African cities in recent years. The cities include Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, Cairo, Egypt, Lagos, Nigeria, Nairobi, Kenya, and, of course, Johannesburg, South Africa. Together, more than 30 million people now live in these African cities, and the numbers are growing. I'm Faith Lapidus.
And I'm June Sims. Have a question or comment about the program? We would love to hear from you. Email us at learningenglish@voanews.com or visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com, and click on Contact Us. Thanks for listening.
The Agriculture Report is next, followed by Science in the News. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Agriculture Report. Family farming has been called the main form of agriculture around the world. The United Nations has declared 2014 the International Year of Family Farming. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says the year-long campaign is designed to increase public understanding of farms owned and operated by families. It says farm families are important producers of food for growing populations. But many family farms do not provide the same worker benefits as large company farms. Many family farms cannot provide retirement plans, health care, or child care. So the FAO wants to get family farming included in national policies that support agriculture. The goal is to create a balanced and equal environment so family farmers can succeed. FAO officials say they will try to learn more about the difficulties family farmers face and ways to support them. Weather problems, price drops, and weak world economies can hurt family farmers. For many, a single crop can mean failure or survival. Family farms operate in different ways around the world. Men run the majority of them. Generally, men own or pay to use the land, decide which crops to grow, and supervise the sales. Women are more often the planters and harvesters of the crops. Very long workdays are usual on family farms. It is difficult for many family farmers around the world to gain the land, water, and other resources needed to farm. The UN has helped establish more than 50 national committees to deal with these issues. The committees are made up of representatives of family farm communities. Together, they decided on 5 goals to reach by 2014. One is to establish policies to make equal the rights of men and women farmers. They also want to guarantee that nations have the right to develop their own food production. The committees hope to require governments to accept and follow certain environmental guidelines, and they want governments of mainly agricultural populations to provide financial support to farmers. Finally, the committees agreed to work to support young people in agriculture. Family farms have been around for hundreds of years. They could continue to exist for hundreds more. But experts say family farms will need support to compete in the face of technological improvements and increasing international trade. And that's the VOA Learning English Agriculture Report, written by Kim Varzi. For more stories about agriculture, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Milagros Ardine.
From VOA Learning English, this is Science in the News. I'm Faith Lapidus.
And I'm Steve Ember. Today on the program, we tell about international efforts to fight a health threat in the West African nation of Guinea. Then we report on a finding that cold air might be good for your health. But first, we report on a medical discovery. American researchers say a drug used to treat breast cancer may help people who have AIDS or HIV, the virus that causes the disease.
A drug used to treat breast cancer may soon have another use. Researchers say the drug could be helpful as a weapon against a fungal infection that kills more HIV/AIDS patients than the disease tuberculosis. The possible new use for tamoxifen was discovered as part of an investigation of older, already approved drugs. The makers of these drugs have sought and received approval from United States government agencies to sell their products to the public. Health experts estimate that a fungus called Cryptococcus infects about 1 million people worldwide every year. The fungal infection is called cryptococcosis. It is especially deadly for people living with AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. Most of the infections take place in African countries south of the Sahara Desert. 90% of the people who have AIDS live in those countries.
Damien Creason is an infectious diseases specialist at the University of Rochester in New York State. He says cryptococcosis can lead to meningitis, a life-threatening infection of the covering of the brain and spinal cord.
It currently kills on the order of 750,000 people a year, primarily, again, in resource-limited regions with high rates of HIV/AIDS.
Two costly drugs are commonly used to treat the fungal infection, but they are not commonly available in developing countries, and they are difficult to give to patients because they must be injected into a person's blood. Experts say that even under the best conditions, 10 to 20% of those who receive this treatment will die. Another drug is often used in poor countries to fight cryptococcosis, but the drug only slows the growth of the infection.
Some researchers are investigating whether drugs already approved for one condition might be useful against another. Dr. Creason and other researchers examined about 2,000 drugs and combinations of drugs for ones that could kill Cryptococcus. They found one, tamoxifen, a drug that has been used for years to treat women with breast cancer. Dr. Creason says tamoxifen is not pricey and seems to help patients in a number of ways.
It can be given orally to patients, which was what we needed. Cryptococcus causes a brain infection, essentially. And so we needed that drug to get to the brain. And tamoxifen actually crosses into the central nervous system very effectively and even accumulates to levels above what we see in the blood.
Dr. Creason published a report on his findings in the journal MBio. He says tamoxifen is most effective against the fungal infection when it is combined with the drug that is already used to treat cryptococcosis in poor countries. More tests are still needed, but because both drugs are already approved, human testing will follow soon.
Mass emergency vaccination programs were launched in Guinea recently to control a growing health threat, measles. Doctors Without Borders and the United Nations Children's Fund announced the vaccination campaigns last month. The two groups plan to work with Guinea's Ministry of Health to vaccinate more than 2 million children against measles. All the boys and girls are between the ages of 6 months and 10 years. The World Health Organization warns that measles is one of the most highly infectious diseases. WHO experts say measles is a leading cause of death among children. The cause is a fast-spreading virus.
The measles outbreak in Guinea began in December. A short time later, the government declared measles an epidemic. This means it has infected many people over a short period. The last measles outbreak in Guinea was in 2009. At that time, the disease infected more than 4,000 children and caused 10 deaths. Most cases of measles are curable, but health experts say vaccination is the best way to keep the number of deaths low.
In February, Doctors Without Borders reported that not enough children had received vaccinations that include protection against measles. It said fewer than 80% of children living in the capital, Conakry, had received such vaccines. Only 37% of all children in Guinea were vaccinated. Dr. Ronaldo Ortunio works for Doctors Without Borders. He says even a single case of measles is one too many.
Measles is a preventable disease by vaccines. You shouldn't have an epidemic, an outbreak in this country. But unfortunately, there are some weaknesses in the Ministry of Health, in the regular vaccination. And of course, with this lack of vaccination of the children, we have an outbreak every 3 to 4 years, which is the case currently in Conakry.
Health officials have been urging parents to watch their children for signs of measles, high body temperature, redness in the eyes, white areas on the mouth, and skin discoloration on the face and neck.
North America was in a deep freeze this winter. Cold air from the Arctic led to record low temperatures in some areas. But now, a new study has found that all that cold air may actually be good for your health. It was so cold in Chicago, Illinois, last month that people were being warned to stay inside. Paige Worthy was born and lives in the place that Americans call the Windy City. She says this was the worst winter she can remember.
It's actually hurt to breathe in because the air is so cold that I actually have to cover my mouth with a scarf to keep my lungs from actually hurting.
Shivering is an involuntary response to cold. It is the subject of a new study published in the journal Cell Metabolism. Researchers say they found that shivering or shaking causes the body to release a natural hormone called irisin. The hormone activates brown fat, the good fat in your body that burns calories and helps to support weight loss. Francesco Celi of Virginia Commonwealth University was the lead writer of a report about the study. He says Irisin has another important role.
Indeed, the purpose of brown fat is maintaining the core temperature, so the temperature of the body whereby all the vital function can be active and normal.
Dr. Celi worked with researchers at the U.S. National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. They already knew the body produces irisin when we do physical exercise. When we exercise, our muscles contract or change in size like they do when we shiver. The NIH researchers believe human ancestors developed the ability to shiver as a way to survive cold weather.
This is the last ditch before going in hypothermia and having severe metabolic and life-threatening consequences.
The researchers studied hormonal changes and how the body uses energy in a group of volunteers who exercised. The volunteers were then asked to lie under cooling blankets, where temperatures were slowly reduced to 12 degrees Celsius.
Most of our volunteers shivered at that time, and the shivering was anywhere between 5 and 10 minutes, no more. And again, we drew blood before and after the study.
The volunteers' bodies produced irisin, but with some surprises.
The amount of increase in irisin was almost identical to what we observed after 1 hour of exercise. This first set of experiments validated our initial hypothesis whereby the maximum stimulation of irisin is probably shivering.
Dr. Celi says understanding how irisin activates brown fat could lead to new drugs to fight diabetes or help overweight individuals.
It's a short-term effect. We do not know yet the long-term consequences of this intervention. So studies need to be performed to address this very question. We do not know if this is advantageous, which individuals would be more able to gain from these interventions.
Back in Chicago, Paige Worthy is pleased to know that shivering may have a physical benefit. Ms. Worthy works as a fitness trainer. She helps people improve their physical condition. She is not sure she will urge her fitness students to be cold and shiver.
As a newly minted spinning instructor, I guess I would say there's risks that go along with every exercise and every weight loss regimen, but this seems like kind of a perilous way to approach your weight loss if it's going to be this cold.
Dr. Celi agrees. Just because shivering and exercise have similar effects on the body, he says, that does not mean standing in the cold should replace physical activity.
This Science in the News was based on reports from VOA reporters Jessica Berman, Jennifer Lazuta, and Roseanne Skirbel. The program was written by Christopher Cruz and produced by June Sims. I'm Faith Lapidus.
And I'm Steve Ember. Join us again next week for more news about science on The Voice of America.